right, nice job. Good set. Let's do some social kick.
All right, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on the Social Kick podcast. I am John Mullen, the host of the Social Kick, and I'm here with some of my good friends, Mr. Luke Pennington, Mr. Brian Lundquist, and Mr. Justin Nguyen. How you guys doing, and what are you drinking here?
It's going good, man. What's going on, John? Good to see you again.
Yeah, I'm hanging in there, just sheltering in place, that's for sure.
I'm actually going to crack it and pour it right now. So I'm drinking a new one that I haven't tried yet. It's a Pacific IPA from Santa Cruz Brewing. It's an organic IPA. 7%, I think. I don't know. I never had it before, but I'll give it a shot.
Sounds fancy.
Nice enough.
It's also in an Abita glass, too, by the way.
Oh, wow.
What kind of glass?
Abita from New Orleans.
Oh, yeah.
I got that one at a bachelor party. Anyway, Luke, what are you drinking?
I got a Juicy Haze IPA, Voodoo Ranger from Trader Joe's. And I put it in my Australian cooler.
Holding it down. Days.
How long did you wait in line at Trader Joe's to get that beer?
I went 10 minutes.
Oh, my God. Well, Jesus. Well, I didn't have to wait in line. I just went right to my fridge. I have a Sierra Nevada Pale Ale from good old Chico, California. So, yeah. John, who's our special guest?
Well, you guys may have noticed, we have someone else here, a much better looking person than us four on the podcast today. So I'm very excited to announce that we have Mr. Tavik here with us today. You guys definitely know him from him being a former world record holder, him having one of the most memorable Olympic races of all time, him versus Mr. Michael Phelps. And now he is in the world of coaching, still involved with the sport of swimming, which many elite swimmers are not involved, which is something we might get into a little bit later. But nonetheless, I want to welcome you and ask you, what are you drinking here tonight?
I'm having some Serbian brandy, and I see you guys all have these special holders. I'm drinking from a Christmas cup. It's a holiday cup, so you know I'm having my drink, and just kind of doing what you guys are doing.
What's the name?
Do as you do.
So I always keep whiskey in the desk drawer at work, which my office is closed right now, but that's always the go-to. You pull it out with some rando cup, and it just seems like a nice close to the work day.
You know, it depends what you're into, but if you're into sales, that it's necessary sometimes.
What I was just talking about the other day is that all these old, like, 1950s films or maybe current TV shows that show an environment from the 50s and 60s, they have these people that have, like, a whiskey and a decanter. You know, they take the whiskey out of the primary bottle and pour it into another glass bottle that's made out of crystal, and they have, like, a drink at 11 a.m.
John, what are you doing with your whiskey?
I could not function that way. I don't know.
During my times in sales, there were many nights where I fell asleep in the fetal position from what a tough day I've had. So, you know, sales in some line of work, it's not for everybody. You learn a lot. But again, depending on what you're into, you see a lot of that in a lot of companies.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Big time. Brian, you got something else?
Well, no, I'm good. Get us started.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't want to take up any valuable time just because, like I said, this is very, very excited to have you on board here, especially with all the Olympics news that's going on, the postponement of the Olympics, obviously postponed to 2021. So last week we had George Bovell on, and he kind of talked about his Olympic experiences as well as his views on what he would have thought if it was postponed the year he was going to it, one of the many years he went. So we'd like to start by just getting kind of your perspective on the Olympics being postponed, and maybe if this had happened leading into 2008, where your mind might have been during that state.
I think the truth is, and just about everyone except there was a post about that Stanford recruit Minnikov, you know, literally speaking his mind. You know, he was angry about it being postponed. And the truth of the matter is, I firmly believe that just about every single athlete was angry, and the right decision has always been to postpone the Olympics. But you know, that's coming from an angle of someone that's rational. You know, I watched the podcast last week with George, and you know, I randomly came across it over Facebook's coach's feed, and you know, listening to him, like, it, you know, I thought to myself, you know, he's right. All professional Olympic level athletes are anything but rational people, you know, and you know, here's a kid from Stanford, and literally, you know, we got to step back and recognize that, you know, he's just a kid. But at the same time, what he was thinking was what everyone else was thinking. And you know, the postponement, had it happened to me in 2008, you know, I would have been destroyed, you know, emotionally and psychologically, just because of the amount of sacrifice, you know, to my life and into my body and you know, just the opportunities that I had, you know, awaiting for me, at least at that point, you know, after the Olympics. I didn't think that I'd go further than Beijing, you know. But I just kind of want to highlight the simple fact that, you know, the postponement, although this, it had to happen for a lot of athletes, I think that this will literally change what the Olympics are going to look like, you know, a year from now. If we're talking about the U.S. Olympic trials, I think a lot of people that would have gone to trials now in June will not be there next year, because their lives are on hold. Their families, if they got partners, they've put their lives on hold. You know, I can't help think, but, you know, a lot of athletes just like, you know, Giles Smith, you know, he told me, he's like, man, you know, I had to find ways financially just to get this whole year of training, just to, you know, to train for this moment. And he's like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And this isn't just Giles, it's a whole lot of people that just don't have the financial backing to make it another year. So for them, this is a different element. But, you know, if you're asking me how I would have dealt with it, it would have been really, really hard. Because again, what you're asking is of somebody who is irrational to wait another year. I had back surgery, and against the advice of just about every single doctor except for one, you know, all of them told me that I would never race again and that I should step away from the sport for, you know, for what's ahead. You know, I had two bulging discs in my back, and you know, my leg was going numb, and I was living in constant pain. So, you know, despite, you know, going against all these doctors' orders, I pressed on. You know, my heart said go, but my body was saying no. And despite, you know, the advice, professional medical advice, and the advice of family and friends, I could not let it go. So if you could only imagine, you know, this was, I had made a decision for myself that would have negatively impacted the rest of my life had things gone worse. A lot of athletes out there have sacrificed the same. And just to ask them to go another year, you know, for people that have trained at that level, that have made their lives exclusively about the pursuit of becoming a champion, there's little doubt in my mind that at least 85% of the athletes, you know, would have gone to the Olympics, regardless of the fear and of the of, you know, everything that's going on. You know, it's irrational.
It is. And, you know, I was talking with another former guest, Brandon Fisher, who's on the U.S. national team, and I don't think he'd be shy to share. He was frustrated because he's an older swimmer who, like you said, has been kind of putting his life on hold. And like you said, he's irrational about his goals and his dreams, which you have to be at this level. And yes, it's frustrated for all the time and energy that, you know, he's put in, that, like you said, Giles Smith has put in, all these swimmers in this situation. So, you know, as a coach now, what advice would you have for these swimmers, maybe to try to keep their mind in the right state as they might be going through another year of, you know, hard, tough, time committing and arduous training?
you know, if you retrospect is 2020, and you know, and when you look at this, and when I look back at my career, you know, I'm not particularly happy or proud of a lot of the decisions that I made along the way. And you know, now that I'm older, I see things a little better than athletes would when they're in. You know, watching George Bovell's, you know, podcast last week and him describing the level of insanity, you know, what a psychopath you got to be to, you know, to train at this level. I mean, I was literally, you know, I was literally feeding myself anything that I was reading in the news. I mean, if I heard one of my competitors went to their grandma's house for a weekend, like I would have been like, yes, because I know he probably stuffed himself silly and he's probably going to come back a little heavier on Monday. You know, like it's these tiny things that, you know, that we focus on and that we feed ourselves on. And you know, if one of my athletes was in position to make an Olympic team, you know, I there's literally nothing that I could tell him to make him feel a little better, but offer him, you know, some perspective. And I truly do believe that this is all a test of character. That whatever that they're going through right now, the extra time is going to afford them the ability to look at all the things that went wrong this year and let's make it better in getting ready for this next year just to ensure that we're that much better. You know, I do believe that, you know, that everything, you know, I even told it to my team, you know, for every single little thing that happens there is some good that will come of it. I know that's not going to make you happy today, but whatever doesn't break you will make you stronger. And, you know, I just think, you know, what a blessing it was for me not to have gone home with the gold in Beijing. You know, the simple fact that I didn't go home with it, you know, it opened up so many more doors to me and perspective and, you know, just, you know, a lot of pro swimmers are philosophers, whether they want to admit it or not. And I keep saying that, you know, Oscar Wilde was, you know, he's one of my favorite poets and philosophers. And he always said that in life, there are two tragedies. One tragedy is to get what you want. And the other tragedy is to not get what you want. And for a lot of pro athletes, the great tragedy, especially on my level, was to, you know, to not go home and hold that Olympic, you know, gold. You know, we've dreamed about it all, you know, all of our lives. But at the same time, I'm one of those people, and this isn't everybody, but I'm one of those people who, had I had that title and that gold in my hand, I think I would have retired. Just because for me, the ultimate dream would have been gone. That was it. There is no more. And for, again, the sensible and logical person, they would say, you know, well, you know what? The right thing to do is to reset your goals and to improve those times, you know, and yeah, just a little bit more. Right. But, you know, when I was growing up, I thought, you know, the ultimate goal for me was to set a world record. And, you know, and I've always wanted to set a world record. Why? Because I wanted to push what was humanly possible, the limits of what is humanly possible. And that's what I wanted to be remembered for. I always dreamed that, okay, you know, I want to be remembered for what I had done in the pool. And to do that, I have to be a part of that squad, that small, you know, fraternity of people that has literally pushed the boundaries of what is humanly possible. And then as I grew older, I thought to myself, you know what? People forget times. People forget records. People do not forget the champion. And for me, you know, just getting older, I thought, you know, if I never want to be forgotten, if I always want to be in the books, you know, I got to be an Olympic champion. So, you know, the pursuit of that goal, like I said, we were all complete psychopaths. You know, you would literally do what is, push yourself beyond what is healthy, what is recommended in pursuit of this never-ending battle, and that is to, you know, be the best. And once you've been there, you know, a lot of people, and I think I would have been one of them. I think I would have, I think I would have lost the fire. And, you know, and later on, you know, at the end of my career in 2012, after having back surgery and after having returned to the sport and been fourth at the Olympics, I was able to walk away from the sport knowing that I'd given everything that I had to give. And because I had literally given my body, my health, my relationships, everything. When I knew that I had nothing more to give, that was when I walked away from that race for the first time feeling nothing. You know, because as swimmers, all of you know that, you know, you race a race and you're always going to feel something. Right. Stephen Prefontaine, he said that a race is a work of art and you can interpret it in as many ways as humanly possible. And the thing about racing your best race or, you know, whatever race, you're always going to feel something. Your teammates are going to feel something. Your family's going to feel something. Everybody feels something. And that was the first time that I literally felt nothing. And that was because I knew that I had given everything and that I had nothing to be sad about. It was what I had, and what I had was at that Olympic Games just not enough. And but yeah, you know, until you're there, you'll never know. And when I talked to my athletes, I had two Olympic trial qualifiers in my group just for them. One of them was very, very young, and the other one is an Air Force postgraduate who's on this really, really cool Air Force program to where they're paying him to train and you know, get ready for the Olympic trials. So, you know, I think that's a pretty cool way of, you know, the Air Force promoting their, you know, their brand and saying that they had somebody out there. But, you know, the guy's also 25, you know, he's got a wife and his, you know, he's waiting for life to start. So, you know, I hope he keeps going just because, you know, Michael Jordan said, I can accept failure, but I cannot accept not trying. And once you've tried and failed, at least you know. And I will never go to sleep thinking or wondering, well, what might have happened had I just gone. Right. So for all those people that are in that limbo of whether to go or not to go, I highly encourage every single one of them, including Giles, to find a way. Because once you do it, regardless of what happens, you're going to have that inner peace and you're going to be able to move on with your life and never look back in that sense.
How did you do it? How did you? You told me a couple of days ago, look, you know, you got to be pragmatic about this and positive. And when you're pragmatic with somebody about it, when you tell them it's real, it can come off really disheartening and really down. And you went through a few cycles of that in your career. You just said it. You know, you went through some downs and you know, you when I met you, you weren't swimming much. At all. And then you went to Beijing and you did one of the most memorable races of any swimmer I remember. And you weren't champion, but we're never going to forget that opening 50. Who's going to forget that opening 50? Who's going to forget that world record? And then you had that huge setback. Then you said, you know, I'm going to go for London. You had back surgery and you say you went from 100 to zero to minus 20 in your level, right? In the gaming level. And you came back, and then you had that setback. Who was the person who told you, who was real with you, yet and kept you going? You kept it real, because I knew you're somebody who don't bullshit me. Tell me what's going on. Yet it kept you motivated every day to go to the pool and train. How do you balance that in your swimming? How did you deal with that? What tools did you use? What tools can I use right now to say, you know what? My coach just told me I got to find a way to afford to live for one more year. I got to find a way to push off that job, that obligation. I got to find a way not to be a pro swimmer for one more year. How am I going to do that and be positive and keep working hard? What tools did you use? Because you did it a few times.
So your question is actually, it's got several different levels. But, you know, for myself, during my career, I took three kind of extended hiatuses. My first one was for 3 months. You know, I took 3 months after the 2004 Olympics. I just wanted just to take a break. You know, I was 20 years old. At that point, my second break was about 5 months, and with back surgery, I had to take a 6-month break just to recover. you know, for me, the greatest gift, and anybody who's again in that limbo of whether to go, whether to continue or not, I would encourage you to keep going, because the greatest gift that I'd gotten from taking all those breaks was when you're out of the water, it renews your passion for the sport, for the pursuit. And I can honestly say that at the end of those breaks, my second break was for 5 months, and that was when George Bovell had moved to Berkeley. And that was when I met you, Luke. And with George, for example, he was living in my apartment because my roommate had gone back to Brazil, Henrique Barbosa. He had moved back to Brazil just for the summer, and George, he was training for 2 months while I was just going to summer school. And every single day I'd ask him, George, so what did you guys do? You know, and he would say what they had done, and he would say, you know, when we finished with Social Kick. So when I saw your podcast, you know, Social Kick for me, it has a deeper meaning. You know, swimming, it's about friendship. It's about grinding hard, you know, and then at the end of workout, just grabbing a board, after you've warmed down, just grabbing a board and just talking it out with your friends. And really, you know, after 2 months of him just coming back and telling me stories about, you know, the Social Kick or what they would do that day, and just the idiocracy of the men's locker room, you know, like I missed it. And you know, he had buffered me and pumped me up to that point to where I wanted to really get back into the sport, and it was the best thing that I had ever done. But, you know, I just wanted to say that with time off, what you're going to get is you're going to be able to step back and reevaluate everything that went wrong and everything that went right, and prepare, you know that you're going to do things a little bit differently for moving forward. Second, I would say that, you know, that renewed drive and that passion, it's stronger than it's more potent than what might've happened had you just kept training. I'm a believer in it. Did subtraction sometimes and break. It's hard to swallow, but I also am somebody that is evidence of coming back and coming back even stronger. You know, so I do believe that, you know, those taking a break, for here in the season, we will not be getting back in the pool until at least May 1st. We'll see how things look a month from now, but you know, if they do take 6 weeks off, 6 weeks is significant the year before the Olympics. But I do think that if they keep their strength up and find ways to keep their cardio up, you know, it's just going to be just fine. But you know, your final point for people that are just looking to, you know, how are they going to get by? If you're a postgraduate or high level athlete training, the first thing that I would do is go to your local swim community, go to your LSC and ask them, you know, would they help you find clubs to run clinics for? That is the first thing that I would do. I'd start reaching out to every single club in the area and even the closest state nearby and ask them, tell them, you know, this is who I am. They already know who you are, but you just, you know, you got to take this humble approach. You know, tell them who you are, you know, that this is the pursuit that, you know, that you, this is your dream. You're just trying to make it, you know, just trying to get by. And if they can help you by starting a clinic, and again, you know, most mid-range clubs, they've got at least, you know, 100 to 150, some 200 swimmers. And, you know, if you can run a couple of sessions with, you know, with these clubs, you know, you do groups of 20 to 30, you know, have it be $50 a pop. You know, 30 athletes, it's already $1,500 for a 60 to 90 minute session. Well, you know what? You could do this for a number of different levels in that team. And you know, I'm telling you, if you do this smart enough, you know, and you're hustling every single weekend, if you go and work somewhere for 5 hours, you can easily go home with $4,500 just like that per weekend of work.
Do you remember the one that I did?
I'm sorry, Brian.
Do you remember you and I did one, Milo, and that's when I realized you can be a great coach. So that was awesome. Go on, Brian.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the things that we've started to see more with the longevity of athletes in sport today, because there's different ways to monetize it than, you know, say 10, 12 years ago, right? So, but even in those days, it was those that were creative that could start to take their careers on a longer path. And I think, you know, because I was just going back and reminiscing, even last week, talking with George about watching the 84 games and Rowdy going, you know, his – and sort of the end of his career and really stretched it out to go to 84. And he's like 25 years old, you know, and now we're seeing guys who are 35 winning. And, you know, so, but the whole, that's not all done the same way. It's not just all through sponsorship of a single company, you know, which I think is sort of a fallacy that, you know, hey, I'm going to go to college and I'm going to get a scholarship. Well, not everybody, especially not in men's swimming. And then, hey, I'm going to, you know, get a sponsorship from a suit company. Well, maybe, but all those contracts are really heavily incentive based, right? So like, there's a huge aspect of you own your destiny. And to do so, you kind of, there's a popular radio show host in the US who says something. I like the way he says it. He says, I know how to go out and kill it and drag it home. And it's like, yeah, if you know, yeah, for those vegans in the world, sorry, but there's there's definitely an aspect of you know, owning that. And I think that professionalism, that in some ways that is what professionalism too is. And I see that with some athletes today at an earlier age, it seems. For Michael Andrew, for example, is such a you know, an interesting example of somebody who seems wise beyond his years, Caleb, for sure. And I mean, and there's a number of examples. Is there anybody today who, you know, who stands out from your standpoint? And what do you, any ideas on how the world's changed and what people can do to monetize and keep their careers going?
The thing about what I know, at least for athletes, you know, at that level, a lot of them are too proud to ask for help. You know, is somebody, when I was younger, I didn't like to ask for help. And, you know, and as far as getting by, you know, I've got no worries for anybody that wants to do it. You know, look, I went from making X amount as an athlete to coaching. You know, I'm living paycheck to paycheck. And before this, I was in a different business. I assure you that I'm not doing this for the money. But because I love this game so much and because I'm so passionate about this, you know, I'm a swim nerd. Every single swimming coach out there, they're all nerds. And we want to help. So whenever somebody needs help, all they need to do is ask. And like I said, you know, in the past I was doing clinics and I would go to one team and they'd have, you know, they have 100 swimmers and I'd say, well, let's break that up into three different groups of 30. And you know, and most clubs will help you because if it's $50 a pop, it's nothing. You know, most people will give $50 for an opportunity to work with someone at that level. Again, you know, this may be unrealistic, but if you just kind of take those numbers, it's $4,500 a weekend. You know, that's $18,000 a month if you want to hustle, right? And if you don't want to hustle and you just want to do it once per month, all you got to do is just find one club that's going to bring you on board, and I promise you, you're going to find a club. Come to the Pacific Northwest, right? You know, go to any LSC. It's, you know, it's realistic. And I think for you and all these athletes, just to reach out to local businesses, you know, they can find a way to write it off. You know, they, you know, different organizations will find ways to write it off and they want to help, you know, they want to be attached to somebody who's going for that American dream or that dream, you know, people, you know, they buy into dreams. And not so much stories, you know. I respect somebody who's, you know, who's struggling, you know. But despite the struggle, they're still fighting for that dream and trying to find a way. There are ways. If you're one of those athletes that just doesn't know, contact me on social media. I'm gonna throw a couple of ideas at you. you know, you know, it's, you know, I'm not saying you're going to get rich, but I promise you, you're going to get by.
I want to ask you some questions about, on the nerdy subject. So I discovered Butterfly late in my career. And you were somebody that I looked at from a technical standpoint. And there, so a couple of the things that stood out to me were that you sort of emulated what I always thought Crocker was really good at, which was straight line butterfly A to B. You'd keep hips high, your upper body would stay high and stay long, and you were really powerful. It wasn't just pop, pop, pop turnover, right? And it, in the same era, it was like Rafa Munoz was a lot of turnover, right? The right. little guy. I'm just curious, especially coming from, you know, your Cal days where you were really good, but not world beating at the time, right? To best in the world and doing things, setting world records. And, you know, the way that you swam was so, so powerful and you were leading from the front, right? What are the, some of the things that you feel like you did really well technically?
I just kind of want to, I kind of want to start this and say that, you know, Ian Crocker is second to no one in talent. You know, the, you know, his precision, the beauty in his stroke, you know, I wouldn't put myself in the same category as somebody who went a 50.40 in leggings, you know, in 2004, that was incredible. You know, you said that I wasn't, you know, world, at the top of the world at college. And, you know, I acknowledge it. I mean, I set a world record, you know, my sophomore year in short course meters, the 100 fly, but, you know, with American swimmers such as Crocker not swimming or training short course meters until that NCAAs in 2004, you know, I didn't kind of let myself feel like I was that world champion just because, you know, the U.S. where the U.S. is, you know, the strongest swimming in the world. If they hadn't had a crack at it, then you can't say it's the world, you know, it's the world record. You know, for me, it was just kind of the world best at that moment. But, you know, with Mike Bottom, you know, Mike, I went to Mike Bottom, you know, for me, I chose my school based on really the coach and my top three schools were Cal, Auburn. And it was SMU, believe it or not. You know, I knew that Lars Frohlander, you know, became, you know, he was training at SMU. He went to SMU and, you know, I fell in love with the city of Dallas and, you know, but for me, it was just like, okay, well, I want to be in position to be the world champion someday. And, you know, and then there was Auburn, you know, and just looking at what Dave Marsh had done with a school that literally nobody wanted to go to, you know, and this isn't throwing shade at, you know, at Auburn. Like, you know, it has got nothing to do with that. You know, for me, it was just like, okay, like if I go to Auburn, you know, I could be swimming with all these great athletes. But at that time, I specifically remembered that, you know, their people were talking about whether their education and their diploma was worth what, you know, that what a college degree was. And this is the true story back then. It wasn't for all the majors, but for some, that was the case. But, you know, with Cal, you know, I had the opportunity to go to a coach that truly believed and was marketed as a swim guru. You know, here was a guy that, you know, was thinking outside of the box. And for me to, you know, work with someone like that and who was so technical, it was a gift just because we were able to develop something that, you know, other people weren't doing. You guys heard about the three styles of freestyle. Well, you know what? And, you know, with Mike Bottom, he was one of the first people that started entering at the top of the stroke with, you know, with flat hands or their pinkies first. Right. And the idea with that is, you know, most people, including Phelps, and if you look at a lot of underwater video footage in fly and freestyle, you know, they enter with their thumbs first and they scull outwards and then scull inwards and then finally scull back. So it's like a question mark kind of look, whereas, you know, it's like, well, you know, that question mark, that outer part, like that's water and energy that you're throwing outward and then inward. But none of that is actually pushing water backward where you want to go. So, you know, it seems so simple, But you cannot teach it, and you can't push it on most athletes that have not established that anchor. You know, where you plant your hand, that's where your hand needs to stay, and your body needs to move past that, your hand. It's not your hand moving past your body. It's your body moving past your hand. So if you watch top-level athletes in the freestyle events, for example, you see the lane lines being blue, white, blue, white, blue, white. Watch their hand in that spot where they place it. If they place it in the white buoy area, you're going to see their hand literally stay there and their body moves past it. So that's perfect harmony with the stroke. And we thought a lot about that. We did quite a bit of sculling, but we thought about ways just to be more efficient and how can we better. And I really did learn a lot from, Mike Bottom. And now, today, you see a lot of sprint flyers literally emulating and using that technique, where that wasn't the case back then.
No, I think this is all. Sorry, I'm going to take it over here. But yeah, I think that's huge information, especially, I wrote an article about that with Phelps, just the huge undulation versus, like you said, just getting those fingertips in, getting that catch. It's crucial. And we'll let Brian maybe ask another technical question, but I know Justin's going to sign off here to go run a fitness class. So, Justin, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, we're going to let you sign off now. Thank you, Milo.
See you, Justin.
I just want to say thank you. Go King. Love what you're doing over there. And shout out to the King Aquatic family over there. I swam over there, so I do appreciate you coming on. And
hey, gentlemen, do you hear me?
Yep.
We're watching.
Hey, yeah. Somebody called me. Just one moment. Let me fix whatever.
Yeah, no, you're good.
Justin, why don't you go ahead and hop on off? Have a good night, young man. Brian, do you have another question that you want to talk about with the?
Do you guys hear me?
Maybe the catch or what?
Yeah, Milo, can you hear us? Oh, went dark.
Well, we'll wait for him to get back on. Like I was alluding to, I wrote an article about just some different catches
guys,
here.
I lost you. I'm not sure.
All good.
How to get you guys back.
We can see you.
Can you see us?
Hey, do you hear me?
Yep. We got you now.
Yep.
I don't. I'm not able to hear you guys for whatever reason. I'm not sure if we're able to restart.
Yeah, you can log out and log back in. We can pour ourselves another drink. I know I can pour myself another drink right now. Brian, you want to maybe comment on some of the biomechanical aspects that he was referring to all people?
For sure, yeah. So one of the things we used to talk about similarly at Auburn was shifting to a shoulder-driven freestyle. And around sort of the mid to late 2000s, that really did start to take off. And that was a popular thing. So, John, you're saying like, well, who's teaching different styles of freestyle? And I think that you would see that Mike Bottom at Cal, David Marsh at Auburn, Dave Durkin at Cal would be teaching what I would call a shoulder-driven freestyle. And the thinking there is that your shoulder is driving the cycle around, and it's not so much what your arm is doing in the recovery. Right, but that you're leading with your shoulder. And so there'd be a lot of drills that we would do technically like that. And I think that the point around the simplicity of the stroke is certainly prudent. And coming back to the undulation of butterfly and where, I've heard, Wade, who we had on our podcast several months ago, who swam at Texas with Crocker and Hansen and some of those guys, one of the things he talked about, the way that Eddie teaches butterfly dolphin kicking, is the smaller the undulation, the better, because, apex or peak of the curve outside of the straighter line is taking you off of the path of being at Crocker in the story is watching Roland Schumann, who in 2005 was the best starter in the world, for sure, better than Crocker. And there's an iconic video of from behind the blocks. You can find it on YouTube today of Crocker and Schumann starting the 50 fly in Montreal Worlds 2005. If you pause the video correctly, all you see are Schumann's feet. Huh. And then you see Crocker's legs. And the thing is, Schumann had his body in 100% a straight line. It's the broomstick example. You hit the water and boom, you accelerate because your body is exactly flat. And some of these ideas are the types of things that Milo was talking about, or that you would pick up at Cal working with Mike Bottom. And these, some of the paradigm and the way of thinking was shifting into a much more simplistic approach. I just want to follow up with you and ask about your butterfly as it progressed too. What are some of the things in butterfly that you would think about that also you think really led to your success?
Hey, so on that note of, you know, the undulation and, you know, we started looking at track athletes doing hurdles, and you look at their head literally stays in the same line, even as they jump over the hurdle. And if you think about it, it's all about forward moving energy. If your body or that head would go above where it would normally go, you know, it's, there's too much movement. You know, your head wants to, it's kind of like a, you know, kind of like a bow and arrow. You know, once you release that arrow, it's flying, and it's flying straight. Now imagine if that arrow went upwards, it would have changed the trajectory of the energy moving forward. So, you know, we started thinking about, you know, what can we do to just kind of keep it, you know, the forward moving energy, and it was to reduce undulation. To do this, you know, it would require a whole lot more upper body strength. You're going to fade a little sooner. But yeah, you know, other than, you know, like when we eliminated the S movement underwater, you know, that was one way. You know, one other thing that you're seeing more and more today, and it wasn't a thing, is as soon as you breathe in the butterfly and the breaststroke, you'll see a lot of people go and drop their face. So they're dropping their faces before the recovery of their arms. In breaststroke, their arms would be at their chest, they would drop their face, and then they drive their arms forward. So in the breaststroke, those that keep their head upwards, the energy is going upward into this peak and then downward. Whereas if you take a breath and you drop your face is as soon as you possibly can, it turns more into a wave instead of a spike going upward and then downward in that energy. So we're just looking at energy going upwards and what direction is it going. So yeah, you know, we reduced the amplitude of the kick. They were smaller kicks. You know, I think one thing that people are forgetting about a lot of times is that second kick in the fly. They don't give it enough love, you know? So really that second kick, similar with the freestyle 6-beat kick, it's constant. Well, in the butterfly, it's gotta be a constant move. It's gotta keep going. You cannot be big kick, small kick. No, it's gotta be, you know, it's gotta keep going. And with that movement, it gives you continuity and energy going forward without stopping.
No, I think that's really important. And I think as we're talking about kind of energy distribution and moving on a forward line, there's a lot of debate on underwater dolphin kick. And obviously in butterfly and almost every stroke now, underwater dolphin kick is huge. And we have Caleb Dressel still doing relatively big undulations where some of the other elite sprinters are doing more shorter amplitude, shorter undulations. What are your current views on underwater dolphin kick and undulation and energy distribution?
You know, one thing that you have to recognize and everyone's got to recognize is there is no one right way to do it. There are just wrong ways to kind of stay away from, I think. Depending on the proportion of whether your torso is long and your legs are short, or you've got really long legs and a shorter torso, that it depends on you know who we're kind of talking about. We've always kind of said, you know, that the winner is doing it the right way because they're the champions. Well, that's not necessarily right. You know, a lot of videos have been made on Phelps's butterfly. And again, you know, if you look at it from a physical and a physics point of view, maybe it's not the most efficient. And that's not me saying, hey, like, you know, you know, a lot of people would say, you know, he's jealous, or, you know, the winner is the winner. That is the right way. But again, if you kind of take a step back and kind of analyze it, it's like, well, what do we need to do to help us go forward? You know, with Dressel having that big amplitude, I mean, the guy is just so dominant underwater. Can you really say that he's wrong. You can't, you know, but I'm a firm believer of doing whatever you got to do. And maybe I just believe that Dressel is so incredibly powerful with that up kick, just as powerfully as with that down kick, that he really utilizes that feel for the water. And that's why he wants to keep it really, really big. Whereas most people, they've got a great down kick, but not as much or is not as strong of an up kick. So it's kind of hard to determine, but I think depending on the proportions of your body, you got to play with the tools, whatever you got.
Definitely. And, you know, speaking of tools, obviously you were, you know, very dominant and obviously had a lot of success as the super suits started to rise up. And some people will argue that the super suits benefited some people more than other people. What are your general views on that? And if you do have an opinion on that, which body types maybe were more successful with the super suits?
I think, anybody that's, you know, everyone that wasn't around or racing in that era, they've got nothing to compare it to. But if you have a bigger frame, or if you've got more muscle on you, or if you're just kind of a chubbier kind of swimmer, let's just call it what it is. If you're one of those people that, you know, just was a little bigger, those swimmers had the most to gain just because it compressed their bodies more. I think with the introduction of Speedo's suit in 2008, or it was 2007, it was for the first time a technology of compressing, you know, of compression. And that was a really, really big deal. The next generation of that was the introduction of neoprene in suits. And, you know, and then at that time, my sponsor was Arena. They were one of the last people to kind of enter that neoprene game. And literally they had just produced a suit, you know, almost the eve of the World Championships in 2009. But, you know, there was J-Kid, and, you know, from what I heard, Brian, you know, you kind of introduced J-Kid to Auburn, and man, you know, it was just a hard time, because at that time, for all those people that were following swimming back then, the first question was who won. And then they would drop a name. And then the second question was not what time they went, but what suit did they wear? Right. And I mean, it was such a wild time that those people that were locked into certain companies, you know, that were locked into, you know, because of their sponsorship agreements, they were helpless and feeling like, well, you know, everybody's talking about J-Kid, you know, what would happen if I were to use that suit instead of my, you know, tier suit or my Arena suit or my Speedo suit? Nobody knew. But there was a lot of athletes that were willing to break contract and pay a fine to wear the suit that everyone else was talking about. And that was kind of sad. You know, I look at today and, you know, nowadays with boys, you know, we're only allowed to wear jammers. And, you know, if you ask me, it doesn't matter what suit you wear today. You know, for girls, since a larger part of their body is covered, you know, it's still a little valid, but, you know, when I think about things back then, it was important. You know, you could, with the J-Kid, they were saying that you could literally easily take 0.5 off of every 50. Right. So imagine that, you know, like across 100 meters, if you want to say that, you know, you were a whole second faster because you wore a suit, you know, that was just the reality we were living in. I mean, I remember Laveau from France. He had a tier agreement, and he wore two, and I even heard one time three body suits at the same time when he broke that world record in the 100 short course meter freestyle. I think it was like a 44.95 or something like that.
Yeah, 44. I think it was 44.91. Sad that I might know that, swim nerds. But yeah, I didn't know that he was wearing two suits in that era. But yeah, that was crazy. You mentioned half a second per 50, and you think about Biederman's world record at 142 flat. Nobody's going sub 144 today.
And guys, for those of you that want to even go back even like 7 years earlier, you know, with Thorpe and that Adidas suit. If you ever had that Adidas suit, the one with
rotation,
It was terrible. It was terrible. You know, you wreck like these suits and this material that was created to cut, you know, to slip through water. And imagine grabbing the water and your forearm just slipping, right? Yeah. So what I heard, and again, this isn't what happened, but you know, I was what I heard, and I'm gonna say it. People that were using those Adidas suits, they were spraying on Teflon, right? And for that reason, a lot of these athletes, they didn't take their suits off after the race. They had to cut them off with scissors.
No way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
story.
Well, Brett Hawk coached me at Auburn for a while, and he used to tell me that they used to cut that suit off, but the suit would float on its own, the Thorpe's Adidas suit. So, you know, I don't know if I never saw it myself, but that was crazy. Yeah, you think about the athletes today and who would benefit the most from suits. That's an interesting thought. I mean, I think of somebody guy like Dennis Rapsis, who's kicking it in the 200 free, but he's kind of a bigger guy. I could see him really tearing it up with a super suit.
We would have a 139 200 freestyle if that guy were to put one of those JK on today.
Wow. Don't you think? And what about this? Can you imagine going 49 mid in a jammer?
I'm glad I'm not swimming anymore.
That's all right. The concept of 17
in track and field, it was impossible to run 10 seconds until the first guy did it.
That's right.
When the first guy did it, then there were a couple of more. And again, there are some barriers that are just not possible. And with Caleb Dressel, you know, there's always going to be one guy that's that generational or once in every five generations swimmers, just like Phelps was, you know. I don't think Dressel's able to produce as many Olympic medals as Phelps, but you know, that guy is special. That guy is just special. I mean, I spoke to, you know, to Greg Troy at the Des Moines Pro Series meet right before they shut everything down. And I said, you know, what are you doing with this guy? He's like, well, you know, last week we did 24 50s all out on 2 minutes. I was like, oh, that guy. You know, and it doesn't sound that bad. It's on 2 minutes until you.
It's horrible. Horrible.
That sounds brutal.
And if he's good at the skins in ISL, that's why he wins the skins, no problem. He does three on 3 minutes. He's fine.
I recently started reading, diving into the biology of swimming book. I want to better understand muscles and lactic acid. And, you know, I would love to have a reading of just Dressel's lactic production and how fast. Just man, you know,
have you read on? Do you know?
I don't know. No. I don't mean, you know, Greg Troy and that Spartan model they have going at Florida, like they, you know, I mean, I remember asking around, like, what is it that Florida is selling these kids and they're looking, you know, they're looking for Spartan like swimmers. It's like you know, they literally, from what I heard, you know, Nesky and I would love to ask Nesky, it's like, you know, but from what one of these recruits told me, that Nesty asked him, and you know, the recruit asked him, like, what are you guys looking for? And he's like, Nesty replied, I'm looking for a badass. It's like, well, what's a badass? It's like, I'm looking for a badass. You know, a badass is a badass. And if you're a badass, you know, you're a badass, and you don't need to define it with, you know, with things, like, you just know it. And, you know, I would love to know just those lactic, you know, those lactate readings, you know, how fast he recovers and how he's able to do it, especially at his age. Like, it's just, I'm going to throw up right now just thinking about it.
I don't understand it. I remember 2008 Worlds, and I was on that team, or Short Course Worlds, with Lochte, and so Troy was on that staff, and he was having me do warm downs, the 2050s on 45 short course meters. And I'm like, man, I'm not going to clear lactate doing this. and I certainly didn't, but it also gave me a perspective on what that's like. But with Caleb, it seems like an anomaly, right? To swim in that program, and to be doing those types of things. I'm on the same board. I'd love to know the lactate readings, because it makes me think that he's that fast and able to clear really quickly too, and maybe not even peak and produce like an elite sprinter would typically produce. Like Nathan's the other end of the spectrum, right? He's producing a lot.
Guys, and you should know, I mean, anybody listening, like, Caleb dressing people of that caliber, all out is all out. They don't go like 93% on, you know, no, they go for it because there is a mission, you know, there is a goal, and the goal needs to be met. Like, you know, it's, you know, I just think about a cat or a tiger, you know, they have to, every single attack has to be perfect. You go for the jugular. If you grab the leg or you grab any part of the body, that meal may run away. Everything has to be precise, and every single set, every single thing you do has to have its why. So whatever Greg Troy is selling, like, you know, I want to hear him. I wish to hear him coach and just to see that energy. I mean, there are some coaches that, you know, could sell a set like that, but I do know that people at that caliber and that level, they don't save up. They go for it. And if nine, he was thrown up and he said, Greg, I can't do it. Greg would believe him. You know, and that's the hardcore. It is that level. You don't take shortcuts. You do it.
Well, all I know is I've talked to the Florida strength coaches and all that about Caleb, and they're like, yeah, he out jumps, outlifts our track athletes, and no one does that on the swimming side. Like no swimmers are even close about that. So that. When he told me that, I was like, wow, that's an interesting perspective about how he is physiologically, because I think, you guys can relate to that physiologically, how, you know, you go in after the weight session for the swim team and there's the track team or the basketball team. And it's like, all right, you guys, yeah, go get your barbells and you can go do that. But being able to outperform them in the weight room is a whole nother perspective.
I just think he didn't meet PK at Auburn. You know, I don't know if that guy's still there.
Oh, PK.
I heard that guy was a psychopath in the right way, you know.
So my freshman year, we did this. In those days, Auburn was doing something called circuit. But it was just a big team building exercise. But, we're outside of the probably realm of influence of the NCAA. We had workouts that would go for 5 hours on a Saturday. And but the end of the dry land season in the fall would be this day called Big Dog Day. And it was just our way of calling and PK's way of calling, the day that he was going to give everybody hell. And as especially early in your career, you feared that. And the upperclassmen actually perpetuated the fear, which I don't know if that was a good thing or bad. But PK released a list of the stations that we were going to do in this weight circuit and dry land circuit in advance of the workout. And so we were freaking out on Friday because there were a series of exercises on there that we had never seen before. And part of the deal, it was military style. You needed to know exactly where you were going to be and be there on command, or else everybody was going to get punished. It was kind of that.
John 15 off.
Usually 45 to a minute on, 15 off. And so we would do
closed windows, blacked out windows. So the air is heavy. It's hot.
You know, And I mean, honestly, is there anything worse than working out in a gym that doesn't smell like sweat? Like it makes you want to work out hard if you're in a dingy gym. But we had a common station throughout the season that was towel hang. So you throw a small like hand towel size over the pull-up bar, and you hold your chin above the bar. But later in the workout, that's kind of tough to do for 45 seconds to a minute if you're 3 hours in. But at the end of the season, we did one. He had one on the list called noose hang. And so what we understood that to be was that there was going to be a noose that you would put your neck through on towel hang, and then you had to hold the towel with your chin above the bar. And the penalty, though, was if you lost your chin above the bar, that your neck would be in a noose. And I remember calling my mom, freaking out. I can't believe this is actually going to happen.
And but for those of you that don't know, this was banned. Like, you can't do this anymore. You know, borderline child abuse for those that, you know. Like
but you know what? I think that was, you know, you talk about, like, Florida wanting badasses. And to be honest, they're the dominant, you know, preeminent program in the SEC today. And that's what Auburn was in those days. And I think that sort of mentality that you would take into college swimming was that you want to be, galvanized so much that you don't fear anything, you know? And I think that's a powerful thing to be able to do, whether that's Dressel doing 24-50s on 2 minutes and not fearing number 18 because he was throwing up, you know, on number 17, right? And I think that there's a lot of value in that as an athlete, is to be able to go, you know what, I'm going to be okay. And after this workout, I'm still going to be living and breathing, and I'm going to have a meal waiting for me. But you know what? Like, this effort isn't going to kill me, so I'm going to give it everything that I got.
I regret not being a part of that. I do recognize just the mental process and how much tougher everybody was just getting out of it. You know, having coached at LSU, I know how warm it gets down there in the South. I just wondered what time of the year did you guys do that? Because that would be pretty miserable if it was in the hot time.
It wasn't in the hot time. It was in the fall. It was always fall. And it was thankfully, you know, not having to do high volume swimming in the fall like a lot of programs are doing, but we were just doing it in a different way. Hey, I wanted to ask you about rivalries. So you were part of one of the, maybe the preeminent rivalry. And I would venture to say that from an individual race standpoint, you swam in the most iconic Olympic race of all time. Part of the magic of that was the rivalry that existed between you and Michael. What do you think, first of all, I mean, one of the things that's so compelling about that is that rivalries don't really exist in swimming all that much. And, you know, we've got a few here today, but are there any that stand out today? And do you think that that's really good for the sport?
One thing that, you know, swimming is lacking in is people verbalizing what they truly think and what they really like. One of the things that I just hate about watching the U.S. Olympic trials is seeing these guys, you know, qualify for the team and then post-race going to talk to the reporter and then being, I'm so happy I'm going to the Olympics with this guy, when the truth is, you know, that guy or those guys just hate each other. They're hugging it out. And that's just kind of one of the things that drives me nuts about USA swimming is they literally pressure everybody. It's like, well, you know what? We're a team. Yeah, of course we're a team, but you know what? I don't like that guy. I'm not going to hug it out with him and say, I love that. I'm going to go share a room with that guy.
Yeah. You know, like,
no. Right. So, you know, you don't hear a lot of, how people feel. And that's something that, you know, boxing and MMA in track and field is ahead of swimming in. And one thing that they understand that USA swimming or just in general, swimming, it feels is behind and is the power of that rivalry, the power of the story, and even the power of what it's going to do to your performance if you take on that rivalry. I mean, training with George Bovell and other guys, you know, at workouts, we would bet, you know, at the end of workout, we would hop up on the block and be like, you know what, I'm gonna whoop you in this, and when I do, you're gonna buy me lunch, you know, you know, and it's simple things, but you know, you would do it not because you wanted the free lunch or not because you wanted to dunk on that guy. You would do it because you verbalized it. Everyone else heard it. And now you got to step up to the plate and do it. And as a result, your performance, no matter how tired you are, you don't want to be that chump. You're going to step up and you're going to produce just because you don't want to be that guy that talked all that talk and couldn't walk the walk. So, you know, again, rivalries, they're really, really important. And, you know, with Sun Yang, with the situation with Sun Yang and the rivalries and, you know, that he's kind of dealing with, I think that, you know, it's really, really important for the benefit of our sport that, you know, these stories are coming up, that you see these polarizing personalities with people that really don't mind, you know, or don't mind being the villain. Now, for me, you know, on this market, I was painted as that villain with the top hat and that mustache that turned up. But, you know, and I don't blame NBC or anybody else doing that just because it's great TV. And a lot of people out there, they don't like me just because, you know, they remember me being the villain. But, you know, and at the same time, like, you know, it's just kind of a necessary thing. But if you just kind of get to know people, yeah. I would always prefer to be in the company of somebody that said what they thought than somebody who was suppressing their thoughts or their opinions on someone else. I mean, you know, the truth is you're either going to like me or you're not. And if you're not going to like me, it's going to be because I'm going to say something that, you know, you're not necessarily going to agree with for X, Y, Z reasons, but at least you're going to know what time it is with me. And that's who I am. And it really bothers me when I run into people that have that wall and forgive me for swearing, but just, they're just full of shit. You know, like, Stop.
No, I think that's crucial. And I was working with Sun Yang, and I was in Australia and China working with him through 2017. And I got to know him personally. And it's very interesting to hear your perspective about being the person that people are against, because, like I said, he's the main person nowadays. So I'd love to know your views about current podium and award ceremony protesting and things like that, and what your whole perspective is on that.
You know, the Olympic Games, if we're going to talk about the Olympics or the World Championships, but let's kind of focus on the Olympics. You know, the Olympic Games is a celebration of humanity and to show how far mankind has come. In the meantime, as years have progressed, they kind of turn it into this tool of propaganda. How many medals has Russia won? How many has China won in the U.S.? And who's the better country? And, you know, they use that to kind of promote their own agendas. And I get the value of that. You know, when you ask me about the podium, I'm coming from a different perspective, and that somebody abused that. You know, I stood up on the podium 12 years ago when I talked. You know, I wore a shirt that, you know, was a political shirt, you know, in support of my country and my people who with a great injustice who lost one of the most important regions of our history, of our people. It is the heart of Serbia, Kosovo. And really at that time, again, I was 24 years old when I did that. At the time when I did that, I hadn't had the clue of the ramifications of doing such a thing. You know, people look at a political protest and they think, you know, okay, he's protesting this and that. But when you literally, you know, I knew when I put that shirt on that the whole world was going to see it. And I knew, like, I literally bought that shirt weeks before knowing that I was going to whoop everyone's butt. And then I was going to put it on and then show everybody, look at me, I'm first place. And this is the shirt I'm wearing. This is what I believe. What I didn't realize, and I was told the reason why I was kicked out of the meet and sent out of the country within 24 hours when that happened. But it wasn't until years later that I recognized the danger of such a thing. You know, there's a lot of militant people out there that feel much differently than you feel, and what I had inherently done, which wasn't fair of me, and I was too young to understand or too stupid to understand, was that I inherently endangered the lives of everybody at that pool, at that facility, at that meet. You know, in swimming, there are no metal detectors. There is nothing preventing somebody from hopping over a barrier from the stands and finding himself in the pool or from the stands shooting. You know, at swimmers in the pool or on deck, or when I walk by in the entrance of the pool, you know, sticking me with a knife, you know. So for me, you know, I look back in that moment and I know I did it for the right reason, but it wasn't the right place or time or platform for it. And you know, and when I look back at that, I would have done it differently. You know, that was not the place and time. You know, I look at all my friends at that pool, and I'm ashamed to say that I had put their lives in danger, And again, from people that come from well-developed countries and you know, like this, you know, that United States, like the United States does not know the kinds of problems that people in the world deal with. You know, I went to Luke's home country and everybody had a gun on them. You know, I was walking through the jungle with George and we went down to the beach and this guy had a huge machete and he was coming at us. You know, and if it wasn't with George also having a machete and telling him to stay cool and to get away, like, there are people, dangerous people out there, but also, you know, they keep talking about if there is a World War III, it'll be an ideological war. Well, people out there are willing to die for their beliefs. And if you're willing to die for your beliefs, endanger yourself and only yourself, but not everyone around you. And that was my big regret and about protesting politically on the podium. I do not recommend it. I hope not to see it in the future. But as far as any other protests, you know, such as is the one against Sun Yang for the doping. I mean, that's something that I would have done. That's something that I would have done knowing myself. You know, for me, respect is everything. If I believe somebody is doping, and throughout my years there have been a lot of people that I suspected were doping, I would not share the same platform as them. I'd beat them, and I'd do whatever I can to not give them the respect of standing and receiving a medal amongst myself and among my peers. You know, I've got a much more draconian approach to doping, and you know, I do in some way support that kind of protest, but all other political protests, please stay away from that.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting perspective, just because, like we said, there's so many different elements involved in this whole thing. So I think we'll get into some of the Facebook questions right now. And Daniel Yang says, I'll buy you a suit.
So funny, I actually grew up with Daniel. He's probably listening right now. He was my best friend for a very, very, very long time. I'm happy to say that I actually still talk to him every now and then. It's kind of cool that he's online. That's what I said to Remark about Phelps in 2009. You know they were talking about suits and the strengths of which suits. You know, I said, you know, he was sponsored at that time, Arena, and you know, and I'll say, hey, we'll, you know, if we can all agree to wear briefs, let's wear briefs in this final. But we knew that just wasn't going to happen. So if you want an arena suit, or you want whatever suit, like, I'll buy it for you. You know what? All these sponsors are just going to give it to you. Don't worry about it. If you say you want it, it's yours. So, you know, I don't know. That was just one of those moments where it's like, I don't want this to be, you know, I don't want this to be an issue. Like, you know, let's just kind of go in there and just race and, you know, but, you know, at the time, people were just afraid. People were just afraid as to what others were wearing. They were insecure. And I just really wish that wasn't a topic of discussion back at that point. You know, I'm happy that we are where we are as a sport and that we're wearing just jammers. Let's just keep it about swimming and not about suits and technology.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. I think you know, it's interesting. I always thought it was funny that the Milo that Michael held up his suit after that race, like the laser was nothing, you know, where the year prior it was the suit that everybody had to have. But the year prior, it was the suit that everybody had to have. And now the next year, it's like it's inferior, like it's not fast. I mean, it was still a really fast suit. But I agree, it's better to just have that discussion completely out of the sport at this point. But the thing that's kind of tough is that, you know, you've got, well, track's kind of going through it right now. And so we've talked about the Nike technology and the carbon plates. And now it's kind of every company is doing a copycat of the carbon plates and track shoes. And then we go back to swimming and look at some of the innovations that have been made, the wedge on the block. And now we've got the backstroke wedge, which, I mean, last summer or two summers ago, I guess, was like a bit of a let's pour one out for the wedge because the wedge didn't have a great, yeah. a great first yeah. meet last summer. But it's a fine line between where is innovation good for the sport and when is it bad? I personally haven't really been a fan of the wedges because I felt like it leveled the playing field and it took away some of the technical aspect of exactly. of being good at starting. So is there anything that you look at swimming and go, we should change this, like dolphin kicking and breaststroke pullouts, et cetera? Where is there good innovation and where should we draw the line?
Well, I just want to say that I got like 2% left on my device, so we're gonna have to.
Okay.
But I do believe that you know, one thing that's kind of always kind of driven me crazy was timing systems and the monopoly of timing systems, the inability to compete, you know, for different technologies to kind of, you know, different companies to enter the market and let, you know, let capitalism do what it does in pushing different companies to provide a better product. You know, as far as the wedge goes, I loved using it. But, you know, again, for somebody to buy a $6,000 Omega block just so that they can use this wedge, like not everybody can afford $6,000 blocks, you know, and why does a block cost $6,000? So a lot of these things are upsetting, and it really has to do with just kind of you know, the inability for new companies to kind of enter certain programs and to compete to bring these things to you know, a reasonable level, right?
Big time. And I think, like you said, you're running out of energy there, you're running out of battery life. So I want to make sure that we have a close off here, just because I think this is valuable information for everyone all listening. So just kind of finishing up here, do you have any last words to share to coaches, swimmers, or Olympic trial qualifiers that are in this limbo right now?
I would just say what I mentioned earlier, guys, everyone, there's going to be some good that's going to come of all this. I know that it doesn't seem apparent. There is a lot of negatives. Let's focus on the positives. I think this mental breather, this physical is just doctor ordered. Use this time to reflect on what went wrong all up until now in your preparations, and let's do it better, right? Positive thoughts. You know, this you know, although this is a great tragedy, I do believe that we get an even bigger and better Olympics next year just for this, right?
It's good advice. Mila, thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it. It's good to talk to you.
Thanks, brother.
All right. Thanks for having me on, guys. Have a great day.
You too, mate.
Yep, definitely. This was great. I really appreciate you and enjoy having this conversation. All right, everyone, we'll be back next week. Make sure you join in. And if you have any other questions, make sure you post it in the comments. We'll see what we can do to get back to you, okay? Until then, be safe and have a good night, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.